The law of expectations. What you expect with confidence tends to happen. What you expect of your prospects, your patients, your clients happens. Take a look at incoming freshmen. Usually that first year of college is pretty tough. And after that first year, many freshmen were not doing as well as they expected. Some were told most freshmen don't do well their first year and things will get better. The next year they did remarkably better than the freshmen they didn't tell that to. Simple things like saying thanks in advance. I'll go ahead and do it unless I hear from you. Advertisers use expectations in their ads. The way a persuader talks, you can see themselves using their product or service. It all comes back to the impact of suggestion. The law of expectation uses expectations to influence reality and create results. Individuals tend to make decisions based on how others expect them to perform. As a result, people fulfill those expectations, whether they be positive or whether they be negative. Expectations have a powerful impact on those we trust and respect, but interestingly, an even greater impact on perfect strangers. When we know someone expects something from us, we will try to satisfy him or her in order to gain respect and sometimes even likability. You've probably heard the saying, what gets measured gets done. The same is true for expectations. That which is expected is what actually happens. Let me repeat that. That which is expected is what actually happens. So if you expect that they're not going to buy, if you expect they're not going to like you, if you expect them to say it's too expensive, you've just influenced reality. People will rise or even lower to meet your expectations of them. This is a powerful force that can lead to the improvement or destruction of a person. You can express an expectation of doubt, lack of confidence, and be skeptical, and you will see the results. If you believe in someone, show confidence in them, and expect them to succeed, you will see different results. John H. Spalding expressed the thought this way. Those who believe in our ability do more to stimulate us. They create for us an atmosphere in which it becomes easier to succeed. When you create expectations, you change people's behavior. Whenever you label specific behaviors or characteristics, the action is expected. When those expectations are not met, you can see anger, disgust, surprise, or even dissatisfaction. As Albert Hubbard said, we find what we expect to find, and we receive what we ask for. Expectations are critical. We communicate our expectations in a variety of ways. It may be through our language, our voice inflections, or even our body language. Think of a time when you've been introduced to someone. Usually, if they introduce themselves by their first name, then you do the same. If they give you their first and last name, you usually do likewise. Whether you realize it or not, you accept cues from others regarding their expectations, and you act accordingly. We all unknowingly send out our own cues and expectations. The power is in using the law of expectations consciously. Numerous studies have shown how the law of expectations dramatically influences people's performance. For example, in one study, girls who were told they would perform poorly on a math test did. In another, assembly line workers who were told their job was complex performed less efficiently at the same task than those who were told it was simple, it was easy, anybody could do it. Another case study demonstrated that adults who were given complex mazes solved them faster when they were told they were based on a grade school level. It is clear to see that if you add the law of expectations to your persuasive repertoire, you can change your audience's expectations of you as well as their future, and you'll be infinitely more persuasive. One thing I've seen, and don't try this at home, guess you can, but I didn't tell you to do it. You tell a coworker, hey, wow, how was your weekend? Well, wait a minute. You look sick. Are you sick? No. The coworker says, no, I'm feeling fine. Why do you say that? Yeah, you're looking sick. No, I'm fine. Then you get somebody else in on it. Hey, you look sick. You're kind of pasty. You're kind of pale. Are you sick? No, I don't think so. Third time, for about the fifth time, are you sick? Yeah, coworker says, I think I'm going to be going home. I think I'm sick. All based on expectations. And most of us heard the famous Pavlov dog experiment, who won the Nobel Prize, trained dogs to salivate at the sound of a buzzer. The training was so effective because the dogs had learned to expect food when they heard the buzzer. Law of expectations. The dogs behaved in a certain way because the law of expectation was at work. Shockingly representative of Pavlov's experiments, the law of expectations has been used in advertising to make humans salivate when viewing a commercial or thinking of a certain brand of food. So you need to expect with confidence. See, often our expectations are based on assumptions we have about people or groups of people. The same is true of ourselves. Have you ever noticed how your expectations become reality in your personal life? Expectation is literally a self-fulfilling prophecy. We do this consciously and subconsciously. Remember the kid in grade school who always was really rowdy and disruptive? Sometimes, if people already assume they are perceived in a certain way, then that is indeed exactly how they will act, even if they don't mean to. The rowdy kid in grade school knew everyone perceived him as disruptive, and so he was. The teacher expected bad behavior, and the expectations were fulfilled. Consider the profound impact this can have in your own life. Are the assumptions and expectations you have about yourself liberating or victimizing? There are countless examples of self-fulfilling prophecies or the law of expectations at work in everyday life. Ever notice how someone who thinks they're going to get fired suddenly experiences a drop in the quality and enthusiasm for the work? What happens next? Well, of course, they get fired. Their belief caused them to act a certain way, and those expectations then work to bring the very thing that at first was only a figment of their imagination. In another study, second graders listened to the statements from their teachers before taking a math test. There were three types of statements: expectation, persuasion, or reinforcement. So the expectation statement was something like this: you know your math very, very well, or you work really hard at your math. Now the persuasion statement involves something like this: you should be good at math, or you should be getting better math grades. Finally, the reinforcement statements, something like this: I'm really happy about your progress. This is excellent work. Now, what do you think the results were? Of course, the scores were the highest in the expectation category. Remember, I'm really happy about your progress. This is excellent work. I know you can do this. Why were the expectation statements the most effective? They created personal assumption within each student, and those assumptions conditioned the actual external results. Our expectations of others affect behavior. When a salesperson's knocking on the door and the door opens and they're wiping their feet in the expectation to come in, it does influence reality. Or handing somebody an open pen with that contract, that expectation does influence reality. You see, the expectations we create for others often become that reality. This can have interesting effects when applied out in the real world. So how can we do this? How can we persuade the behavior of other individuals? For example, let's go back to school teachers, something we've all experienced. Now, under the umbrella of expectations, teachers can be the greatest asset or the greatest destruction in a child's life, all based on expectations. We know what happens when a teacher labels a student troublemaker because it creates a certain expectations for the student actions. We've also seen the labels slow learner, behind, stupid, ADD become projections for one's future academic success. There is a story of a substitute teacher who came to class and found a note from the regular teacher labeling one of her students as a troublemaker and labeling another student as helpful. The substitute teacher began the class looking for these two students. When she found them, she treated them accordingly. However, when the teacher returned, she was amazed that she discovered the substitute felt the troublemaker was helpful and the helper was trouble. The substitute had gotten them mixed up. Based on her expectations is what happened. See, the children's behavior was based on the substitute expectations. This is often called social labeling. People tend to live up to the positive or negative label bestowed upon them. Now, on the flip side, we've all had teachers who had high expectations of us and brought us to the next level. Can you imagine how powerful this becomes? Imagine the first day of class as a teacher looks around the room with their students. What if she had an Asian student who was the son of a distinguished professor versus one who was the son of a previous student who was a class clown? What if her students were heavily pierced and wearing all black? What do you think her assumptions and expectations would be? Her expectations would probably be fulfilled without even speaking to those students. One interesting experiment revealed how teachers' expectations influence students. Two Head Start teachers were selected who were as equal as possible in potential and in practice. Pupils were then carefully tested and two classes were formed that were as similar as possible in background and learning potential. Next, the principal spoke with each teacher alone. He told the first teacher how fortunate she was. "You have a class of high potential pupils this year. Don't stand in their way. They're racers and ready to run." And the second teacher was told, "You know, I'm sorry about your pupils this year. You can't expect top students every year. Just do the best you can. We'll be understanding regardless of the results." At the end of the year, the two classes were tested again, and you've guessed it. The first class scored significantly ahead of the second. The only main factor appeared to be the teacher's expectations. What about schools on grubby day? You know how all the schools have dress-up day, Halloween, spirit day, pajama days, 50 days, 80 days, whatever it is. In one high school, they had grubby day. As you can imagine, on this particular day, the student behavior was less than outstanding. The administration received more complaints about student behavior on this day than any other. The dress code set up certain assumptions, which further set up certain expectations. Then, of course, the expectations were fulfilled by the bad behavior. Another example, littering. We know that children tend to put their trash directly on the floor. In one study done at an elementary school, students were given individually wrapped pieces of candy. Of course, most of the wrappers ended up on the floor and not in the garbage can. Over the next 2 weeks, the teacher frequently commented on how neat and tidy the children were. On a visit to the classroom, the principal remarked to the children that their classroom was one of the neatest and the cleanest in the school. Even the custodian wrote a note on the blackboard telling the children how clean and tidy their classroom was. At the end of the 2 weeks, the children were given individually wrapped pieces of candy again. This time, most of the wrappers ended up in the trash can. Even parental expectation. Whether it be with children or adults, expectation becomes reality. One thing you will notice with toddlers and small children is that they behave according to the expectations of their parents. When I was single, I noticed children running and playing and sometimes bumping their heads or falling down. I also noticed that they would look at their parents so they would know how to react. If the parents showed great concern and pain in their eyes, their children would start to cry in an effort to get attention they needed. This would happen regardless of whether the child really felt pain or not. One of the techniques my wife and I tried as parents was the exact opposite of this approach. We changed the expectation, and I'm telling you, it's worked great. When our children hit their heads or get a small scrape, they look up at us and we laugh. The amazing thing that happens is that they begin to laugh too. They realize it's not a big deal and go off to resume their activities, often laughing with us. Now, I'm not talking about severed limbs or severe cuts, just basic bumps and bruises. Children act based on the expectations of their parents. You create the expectations in your voice, in your actions, and with the words you use. Studies show that children will live up to the expectations of their parents, whether these expectations are positive or negative. An amazing statistic, Bill Glass stated, over 90% of prison inmates that were told by parents while growing up, they're going to put you in jail. Ouch. Even in a blood drive. Often when blood drive organizers make reminder calls, they end their conversations with something like this. We'll see you tomorrow at 10 o'clock then. Okay? And then wait for the person's commitment. Why do they do this? Studies have shown that when you create dissonance and an expectation, attendance rates dramatically increase. So expectations work, whether it be in a school setting, in a sales setting, in a persuasive setting. It is power. In fact, extensive research from Dr. Kerman has shown that teacher interaction with students perceived as low achievers, they are less motivating and less supportive than interaction with students perceived as high achievers. Now, when you ask a teacher if this is true, they'll never admit to this. But as they monitor them, they notice that they didn't give low achievers enough time to answer questions. Often, they would give the higher achievers clues to answers to the questions. They would give high achievers the benefit of the doubt. They would act more friendly to high achievers. They'd be less accepting of low achievers. The seating assignment usually showed the low achievers seating away from the teacher. Overcritical, insincere praise and encouragement, expecting less work from the low achievers, interrupting the low achievers more frequently. Again, these are all subconscious choices. In fact, one of my favorite stories comes from Winston Churchill. He gave a speech entitled, A Colossal Military Disaster. This was back in June of 1940. Actually told it before the House of Commons. It was a story about Teddy, which is evidence of the power of expectations, especially teacher expectations. Teddy certainly qualified as one of the children least interested in school. Musty, wrinkled clothes, hair never combed, one of these kids in class with a deadpan face, expressionless, sort of a glassy, unfocused stare. When Miss Thompson spoke to Teddy, he always answered in monosyllables, unattractive, unmotivated, and distant. He was just plain hard to like. Even though his teacher said she loved all her class the same, down inside she wasn't completely truthful. Whenever she marked Teddy's papers, she got a certain perverse pleasure about putting X's next to the wrong answers. And when she put F's on top of the paper, she did it with flair. She should have known better. She had Teddy's records, and she knew more about him than she wanted to admit. The records read, first grade, Teddy shows promise with his work and his attitude, but poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy could do better. Mother is seriously ill. He receives little help at home. Third grade, Teddy is a good boy, but too serious. He's a slow learner. His mother died this year. Fourth grade. Teddy is very slow, but well-behaved. His father shows no interest. Christmas came, and the boys and girls of Miss Thompson's class brought her Christmas presents. They piled their presents on her desk and crowded around to watch her open them. Among the presents, there was one from Teddy Stollard. She was surprised that he had brought her a gift. Teddy's gift was wrapped in brown paper and held together with scotch tape. On the paper were written the simple words, "For Miss Thompson from Teddy." When she opened Teddy's present, out fell a gaudy rhinestone bracelet with half its stones missing and a bottle of cheap perfume. The other boys and girls began to giggle and smirk over Teddy's gifts, but Miss Thompson at least had enough sense to silence them by immediately putting on the bracelet and putting on some of the perfume on her wrist. Holding her wrist up for the other children to smell, she said, "Doesn't it smell lovely?" The children, taking their cue from the teacher, readily agreed with their oohs and their ahs. At the end of the day, when school was over, the other children had left. Teddy lingered behind. He slowly came over to her desk and said softly, "Miss Thompson, you smell just like my mother, and her bracelet looks really pretty on you, too. I'm glad you like my presents." After Teddy left, Miss Thompson got down on her knees and asked God to forgive her. The next day, when the children came to school, they were welcomed by a new teacher. Miss Thompson had become a different person. She was no longer just a teacher. She had become an agent of God. She was now a person committed to loving her children and doing things for them that would live on after her. She helped all the children, especially the slow ones, and especially Teddy Stollard. By the end of the school year, Teddy showed dramatic improvement. He had caught up with most of the students and was even ahead of some of them. She didn't hear from Teddy for a long time. Then one day she received a note that read, "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. I'll be graduating second in my class. Love, Teddy." 4 years later, "Miss Thompson, they just told me I'll be graduating first in my class. I wanted you to be the first to know. The university had not been easy, but I liked it. Love, Teddy." And 4 years later, "Dear Miss Thompson, as of today, I'm Theodore Stollard, M.D. How about that? I just wanted you to be the first to know. I'm getting married next month, the 27th to be exact. I want you to come sit where my mother would sit if she were alive. You're the only family I have now. Dad died last year. Love, Teddy." Miss Thompson went to the wedding and sat in the place where Teddy's mother would have been. Miss Thompson deserved to sit there. She had done something for Teddy he could never forget. Expectations are critical not in only everyday life, but in the world of sales and persuasion. The power of suggestion can also be extremely effective when you engage the emotions in your techniques. For example, when your car salesman says, "You're really going to love how this car handles in the mountains," he is shifting the focus away from the sale and creating an exciting image in your head. He is also speaking as though he had already agreed to the sale because you wouldn't be driving it in the mountains unless you're going to buy it. He's acting like it's a done deal, and the truth is, the more he does this, the more it is. Or another expectation. Have you ever felt bad about leaving a store or situation or a salesperson where you feel a little guilty that you haven't bought something? That person or that store has created the expectation that you would make the purchase. Or what about the expectation where you see basketball or football professional athletes, or even in the high school or college level, the expectation that it's a first down, the expectation that it was good, the expectation that the ref made a bad call. Now, the refs would never agree, but a lot of times this does influence reality. Well, what about the landmark study done in the 1970s by Philip Zimbardo? Now, they don't allow these type of studies anymore, for obvious reasons. What he did is he built a mock prison in the basement of the university psychology building. He took a 35-section of corridor and created a cell block with a prefabricated wall. Three small 6-by-9-foot cells were created from laboratory rooms and given steel-barred black-painted doors. A closet was turned into a solitary confinement cell. And then, advertised in the paper, they were looking for volunteers to participate in this experiment. And 75 people applied. So they picked 21 out of the 75 that appeared the most healthy and the most normal on psychological tests. Half the group was chosen at random to be guards and were given uniforms and dark glasses and were told their responsibility was to keep order in the prison. The other half were told they would be prisoners. And they even got the police department to arrest them in their homes, cuff them, and bring them down to the station house, charge them with a fictitious crime, fingerprint, blindfold, the works. They were given prison uniforms to wear and an actual number. The real purpose of the experiment was to find out why prisons were such nasty and bad places. But what shocked them is that the guards, who many described themselves before the study as pacifists, fell quickly into the role of hard-bitten disciplinarians. The first night, they woke up the prisoners at 2 in the morning, made them do push-ups, line up against the wall, and other things. The morning of the second day, the prisoners rebelled. They ripped off the numbers, they barricaded themselves in the cells. The guards responded by stripping them and spraying them with the fire extinguishers and throwing the leader of the rebellion in solitary confinement. Things were getting abusive. There was yelling. And it actually created, in this study, an atmosphere of what they called terror. The guards made the prisoners say to one another they loved each other. They marched down the hallway in handcuffs and paper bags over their heads. After 36 hours, one prisoner began to get hysterical and had to be released because of the extreme emotional depression, crying rage, and the anxiety. Zimbardo was going to do this test for 2 weeks, but they called it off after 6 days. At the end of the study, one prisoner said, "I began to feel I was losing my identity." And Zimbardo's conclusion was that specific situations are so powerful that they can overwhelm inherent predispositions. It was the expectations of those guards to act that way, and one thing led to another. I just want to illustrate the power of expectations. Of course, we can use this in a very ethical and productive way. One thing you can use is known as the presupposition, or what we call assuming the sale. Using expectations, we can create immediate reactions to stimuli so the subject doesn't even have to think. They just perform the action. Discounts, closeouts, going out of business sales, and coupons are used to draw traffic into stores. Consumers assume they'll receive a reduced purchase price by presenting the coupon or going to a going out of business sale. Interesting note, one tire company made an error in printing their coupon, and the misprinted coupon offered no savings at all to the recipients. However, this coupon produced just as much customer response as did the error-free coupon. You see, presuppositions is often utilized by words and language that indicate your assumption and your offer has already been accepted. It is a technique that is used both consciously and subconsciously. Consider the following examples. When do you want your couch sent? What does that mean? It presupposes you want the couch. Should I call you on Tuesday or Wednesday? Presupposes you want to talk again. Your first class will start next Monday, presupposing you're signing up for the class. You'd be amazed how often just go along with your proposal. It's an expectations. You're a persuader. You help them make the right decision. They don't even stop and think about their response because now they're already finished with the deal in their mind. And nobody will work with you. Nobody will do business with you until they can see it in their mind first. They can see themselves doing what you're asking them to do. Another way to use presuppositions is to put it in writing. People always think that if something is in writing, it must be true. We often go along with something we see without questioning it just because it's what the directions say to do. For example, a particular candid camera stunt was pulled when a stop sign was placed on a sidewalk, even though there was no reason to stop there. And there was no danger of oncoming traffic, everyone obediently stopped and waited at the sign, just because it said to do so. In another spoof, a sign reading Delaware closed actually made people start asking how long Delaware was going to be closed for. Then, of course, there's the placebo effect. One form that expectations can take is the shape of a placebo. Now, we all know a placebo is a non-medicinal substance that is given to patients so they believe they're receiving medicine. Placebos were used during the Korean War when MASH units ran out of morphine. Medical workers gave wounded soldiers placebos, and 25% of them reported a reduction in pain. The placebo works because the explanation that the medicine will help is so strong that our brains actually translate it into reality. In some studies, placebos work 25 to 40% of the time. There's research been done on police officers who died when somebody shot a blank at them. People that think they're taking aspirin, but it's a placebo, their headache goes away. You put someone into a retirement community, they die. They know it's the last step, and mortality rates for both men and women double after admission to a retirement home. Even the Nazi concentration camps fed off the psychological expectation of death. Prison guards instilled hopelessness in prisoners. They created a psychological environment whereby the prisoners came to expect no chance at survival. Prisoners exhibited powerlessness and an inability to cope and diminished will to live. In a sense, a self-imposed death sentence. One amazing example of the placebo effect occurred in Israel in 1991. Israeli citizens were seen wearing gas masks during Scud bombings. Shortly thereafter, hospitals reported dozens of people complaining of symptoms of chemical weapons that were never used. The gas masks were just a form of protection in case of biological warfare, but just seeing others wearing one caused people to become ill. I have even used the placebo effect on my daughter. At times, she had trouble sleeping at night and needs a little nudge. I tell her a special pill, it's actually a vitamin, that will put her right to sleep in 5 minutes. Without fail, she's happily sleeping before the 5 minutes are up. What about time expectations? In our modern world, we are bound by time. This being the case, we have certain expectations about how time works and how long it will take us to accomplish something. Often, time becomes distorted through our perceptions and expectations. Think about it. Why do some afternoons speed by faster than others? And why do we finish projects 1 minute before the deadline? Parkinson Law states that work expands to fill the time available. So if a project is given a 3 month deadline, it'll take a full 3 months to complete. If that very same project is given 6 months time frame, it'll take the full 6 months. Now, it may say strange, but the law has bearing because the time allotted for completion sets our expectations. In actuality, our expectations that influence how we will work on a project and therefore how it will be completed. Ever notice how there's a sudden burst of activity right before the deadline appears? We've all had tendency to procrastinate, waiting until the final wire to do most of the work. This is why it's often effective to set multiple deadlines for large projects. Projects without deadlines never seem to be accomplished, no matter how good the intentions are. What about reputation expectations? The most effective psychological tool for getting someone to follow through is to let him know that you believe he is the type of person who will follow through. Using phrases like, you're the kind of person who, you've always impressed me with your ability to, or I've always liked the fact that you, and fill in the blank. They all invoke the powerful psychological law of internal consistency. Winston Churchill, one of the greatest masters in dealing with people, said, I have found the best way to get another to acquire a virtue is to impute it to him. When people are aware of the good or bad opinions other people have about them, they will live up to those opinions. This is why we act out of the roles assigned to us. If we receive praise, we want to be worthy of that praise. There was a police officer who always seemed to be able to get even the toughest criminals to open up and tell him everything. This technique was to tell the criminal, I know you have a reputation for being the tough guy who's been in a lot of trouble, but everyone tells me that the one thing that stands about you is that you never lie. They tell me that whatever you say is always the truth no matter what. Think about that. Honestly assess how you think you make others feel when they're around you. Do you make them feel small and unimportant, or do you inspire them to achieve more? Your actions towards others will tell them how to feel or think about them. The great writer, poet, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe once stated, treat a man as he appears to be and you make him worse. But treat a man as if he already were what he potentially could be and you make him what he should be. What about first impression expectations? Have you ever noticed how people you assume are going to be jerks turn out to be just that? And if there is someone you're especially excited to meet, then you meet him or her and they seem great. Often our assumptions and our expectations about someone we're about to meet for the first time play out exactly as we've already mentally conceived them. And remember, even when first meeting someone, you will send subconscious messages about how they are supposed to respond and behave. In a particular study, a group of high school students were brought together to hear a speech on how the minimum driving age should be raised. Half the students were told to focus on the speaker's speaking style, while the other half was forewarned that the speaker considered teenagers to be horrible drivers. 2 weeks after the presentation, the students were asked to fill out a questionnaire. Overall, the first group rated the speaker favorably and even leaned in favor of the position he asserted. The second group rated the speaker as hostile and seemed to have tuned out his message altogether. Because of the expectations they were set up to hold, the second set of students were already defensive before the speech even started, leaving little room for persuasion. Then you've probably heard of embedded commands. An embedded command is a technique used to communicate to the conscious mind while also sending a message to the subconscious mind. The idea is to actually bypass the conscious mind and communicate directly to the subconscious mind. Embedded commands is a technique commonly used in marketing and advertising. Often, the embedded commands are small fragments that fit into a full sentence and which are digested by the conscious mind. Here's an example. Pepsi used to have a slogan, have a Pepsi day, with the embedded command, have a Pepsi. Studies done at Harvard University show that subliminal commands evade scrutiny by our normal waking consciousness and are retained in our unconscious secondary memory. Certain trigger words have a positive impact on motivating people to take action. So when you use these embedded commands, they create motivational triggers. So many times, information can be processed without conscious awareness. In another study, they found that the unconscious mind can work autonomously and lead to behavioral change without conscious awareness. It's true with embedded commands, and it's true with many laws of persuasion. They go underneath the radar because they're subconscious trigger. The most effective embedded commands are short and concise. They should be no longer than 2 to 4 words. It is much easier to use these commands in persuasive writing because you can visually highlight the command. When using this technique, first determine what exactly you're trying to say to your audience. Then create the sentence where the embedded words and phrase will logically and contextually fit. Finally, set the embedded commands apart in some visual way. Italicize, bold, underline, highlight, or even use a different color. You see, embedded commands are also powerful in speaking. Certain phrases have specific command forms that follow 2 to 4 words. Certain phrases have specific command forms that follow the 2 to 4 words rule. Phrases can include word associations, cause and effect statements, presuppositions, questions, hints, suggestions, or even analogies. See, let me explain this. Essentially, we are looking for phrases that jump out at us. Consider the following. Become wealthy. Use this material. Going to happen. Feel good. Act now. Become really interested. Use this process. Enjoy life. Learn how. Buy now. How good it feels. Read each word. Follow my lead. Change your life. You will understand. Learn quickly. Use a skill. Improve your results. Now, on the flip side, many people use this the wrong way. Think about these. Don't forget. Don't crash. Don't be nervous. Don't break that. The embedded command is forget. Don't forget. You should say, please remember. Don't crash. No, please be careful. Don't be nervous. You're commanding them to be nervous. Do you see how this works? Studies show that embedded commands can actually change our attitudes or beliefs, even if we're totally unaware. It is in this way that the embedded commands are effective. The conscious mind has no opportunity to analyze or evaluate the material. We then can create expectations of behavioral change with embedded commands, using both direct and indirect suggestions. The subconscious mind will create an internal reality to match the commands. And then there's goal setting. Is that important in persuasion? Wow, it's critical. In fact, many people don't like the idea of goal setting or even hearing the word goal setting. It just makes them cringe. Now, hold on here. There's no doubt that goal setting works. We know it works. The problem is most people aren't doing it in the right way. And I'm not going to spend the right time and aspects of goal setting. That's for another series. The bottom line is that goal setting works, and it's an important aspect of the laws of persuasion. If you can help others make goals, it increases their future expectations for themselves. Visualizing themselves reaching their goals also makes achievement of those goals more tangible. Goals must have the power to stretch and inspire. They must be realistic in the mind of the person being persuaded. Research shows that goals dictate future performance. Conscious goals influence our overall performance. In one study, there was a large difference between asking someone to do their best and helping them set their goals or standard for their performance. It is a general rule that the greater or more difficult goals actually increase performance. The reason for this is that lofty goals set higher expectations. And as already discussed, expectations strongly influence behavior. For example, in a production plant, a group of workers with less experience were divided in two. One group was told simply to observe the experienced workers and try to be able to perform at a skilled level within 12 weeks. The second group received specific weekly goals that were progressively more and more demanding. Needless to say, the second group fared much, much better. Another thing to take a look at is the environment. Your environment and the expectations of that environment should be persuasive. There's a theory asserted by James Wilson and George Kelling called the broken window theory. In this theory, they suggest using a broken window as an example, that a building full of broken windows will cause people to assume that no one cares for the building or its appearance. This, in turn, will spur more vandalism. In other words, the environment's condition gives suggestions or expectations that lead people to certain assumptions, and people then act on those assumptions. When the sink is full of dirty dishes, it's much easier to put in one more dirty dish. The broken window invites a greater vandalism and crime. In his book Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell uses the example of the broken window theory as he explains the New York subway cleanup. The subway system was in dire need of rebuilding, a multi-billion dollar endeavor. With the system about to collapse, the focus was understandably on the issues like crime reduction strategies and subway reliability. See, George Kelling, a consultant hired by the New York Transit Authority, urged officials to utilize the broken window theory. David Gunn immediately assigned people to start cleaning up all the graffiti on the subways. Removing the graffiti seemed to be such a little consequence compared to everything else there was to worry about, but Gunn was insistent. In fact, this is what he said. The graffiti was symbolic of the collapse of the system. When you looked at the process of rebuilding the organization and morale, you had to win the battle against graffiti. Without winning that battle, all the management reforms and physical changes just weren't going to happen. We were about to put out new trains worth about $10 million apiece, and unless we did something to protect them, we knew just what would happen. They would last one day, and they would be vandalized. And what Gunn did is set up specific goals, timetables, and even cleaning stations. If any train came back with graffiti, it had to be cleaned immediately before it could go out again. For the vandals who spent their nights toiling into the wee hours of the morning painting their murals, it sent a strong message, seeing their masterpieces already painted over again by the cracking of the next morning's light, told them they were wasting their time. The entire anti-graffiti campaign took years, but it finally subsided. The hope and expectations you can create in your persuasive environment will forecast your ability to persuade. One experiment was conducted on the influence of light. Lab rats were placed in jars of water to see how long they would try to keep swimming before giving up. Some of the jars were placed in complete darkness, while others had the light shining into them. The results were dramatic. The rats in the dark swam for about 3 minutes before giving up. The rats with the light swam up to 36 hours, 700 times longer than the rats in the dark. What type of environment do you have? Do they hope? Can they see the future? Can they see themselves using your product or service? Another form of expectation is pacing and leading. This is part of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. Pacing involves establishing rapport and making persuasive communication easier. Pacing and leading will enable you to direct a person's thoughts so they tend to move in your direction. When you pace, you validate your prospects either verbally or non-verbally. That is, you're in agreement or rapport with your prospects. As a result, they feel comfortable and congruent with you. Pacing entails using statements everyone accepts as true. By doing so, you eliminate disagreement and get others to agree with you. The topic either can be proven true or is commonly accepted as truth. Once you've established rapport and harmony with your prospects, you can create expectation of agreement. You must have a general agreement before you can lead your prospect to your point of view. You then begin to use statements that you want your prospects to agree with, even though they haven't consciously and or publicly acknowledged that they do. So put pacing leading in a nutshell. Pacing statements are obviously true. You want to use probably three of those in a row so the prospect can accept their validity. Then you use a leading statement. Again, 3-to-1 ratio. 3 paces to each lead. And a leading statement can't necessarily be proven true, but they represent what you want your prospect to believe. For example, here's a pacing question. Most people would love to be financially free and end their money worries forever. Now here's a leading question. The answer to your financial problem is providing the right training at the right time by the right person. Expectations influence reality. This law can be used for great good. This law can be used for great evil. Manage your expectations of your clients, your prospects, and your customers, and you'll see your ability to persuade skyrocket.